broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University. This is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. It's time now for a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with host Harold Wilson.
The Middle East's recent cascade of epic shifting events, known as the Arab Awakening, has shifted its political center of gravity from an older generation steeped in an authoritarian mindset to a younger one, eager for greater personal liberty and individual autonomy. The youth of the Arab world are now the prime object of attention for anyone concerned about the region's future. Carol Murphy, in A Kingdom's Future, Saudi Arabia Through the Eyes of Its 20-Something. Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. We're honored to have Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Carol Murphy in our studio today to talk with us about the Middle East. I've also asked News Director for Delmarva Public Radio, Don Rush, to join us as well. Carol, welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here.
And welcome to you, Don, for joining us to talk about the Middle East as well.
Well, good to be here.
A longtime reporter for the Washington Post, Carol was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting and the George Polk Award for Foreign Reporting for her coverage of Iraq-occupied Kuwait and subsequent 1990-91 Gulf War. At that time, she was the paper's Cairo bureau chief, responsible for covering the Arab world. Carol has also been based in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, where she reported for the Christian Science Monitor, Global Post, and The National. She was also a public policy scholar at the Middle East program of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington, D.C. Her fellowship was spent writing her latest book, A Kingdom's Future. Carol is also author of Passion for Islam, a wonderful book on the role of Islam in the Arab world. What a distinguished career, Carol. We're truly honored to have you here this morning. How did you get started in journalism?
Well, it's a long story. I'll give you the short version. When I was in my 20s, I had graduated from Trinity University in Washington, D.C., and I really didn't know what I wanted to do. But I did go to Africa where I was a teacher for 2 years, and then I did assorted other things. I traveled, etc. And I finally decided that I really wanted to be a journalist, and I really wanted to be a journalist writing about foreign events. So I went to Africa. I was on my way to South Africa, but I stopped in Angola, which at the time was about to get its independence from Portugal. And I was going to stay there just for a visit, but I ended up staying a couple of years because I got involved with journalism there. And I was stringing for Newsweek and the Washington Post, which at that time were owned by the same company. And then I got arrested and put under house arrest by the new MPLA Angolan government, and then they deported me. So I was in Lisbon with no money and no job, and I called the Post and I said, you know, it was a story I wrote for you that got me in trouble, so what can we do? And they paid my way to Washington and gave me a 6-month probation job, and I passed probation. So that's how I got started.
What were you doing during your probation work in Washington? We like in CIS, do we call you proby, or are you well beyond that now?
I was working on the metro desk and covering schools in Fairfax County and various sorted other things, sort of a general assignment reporter.
And so from there to Egypt, was that it?
No, then the Post needed somebody to cover events in South Africa. So they sent me there in 1977, and I stayed till 1981. Then I came back to Washington, and I covered federal court and immigration. And then I wanted to go back overseas, so I begged them to let me go to Cairo. And they said no, and they sent a guy instead. But 2 years later, when his tour of duty was up, I begged them again to go to Cairo, and they said yes. So that's how I ended up in the Middle East.
So that got you well to the Middle East. Well, in your book, which frankly I think is amazing.
I thank you.
Passion for Islam. Yeah, it really, really is. But you argue in that book that the religious terrorism emanating from the Middle East has to be understood. Not excused, but understood, in the context of three historical forces. They include Islam's reawakening, the subsequent internal turmoil, the enduring presence of authoritarian governments, and the failure to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Carol, to start us off on these policy issues, What is the Arab Awakening?
Well, the Arab Awakening began in December of 2010, and it began with a very small incident. There was a vegetable seller in a small town in Tunisia, and he had an altercation with the local policewoman. And he got so frustrated by that, because here he was, a poor guy trying to make a living, and she was making it hard for him. That he set himself on fire and he died. And this started a series of events in Tunisia, which ended up with the longtime dictator Ben Ali of Tunisia fleeing for his life. The Tunisian government significantly did not support him. So they, you know, twisted or swung the balance in the favor of the people who were demonstrating in the street, who were mostly young people. Now, this event became an example for other young people in other Arab countries. And these young people were motivated by the lack of employment opportunities, the lack of housing, available affordable housing, the lack of their political participation, just the brutality of so many security police forces in these countries. It really had nothing to do with Islam per se. So that's why the Arab Awakening initially had a sort of a secular bent. But it spread to Egypt was the next biggie, and then Bahrain, and then Yemen. And it spread also to Syria, which turned out to be very different from places elsewhere. We can talk about that later. Basically, this was initially called the Arab Spring because people's hopes were very high that these authoritarian governments were going to be replaced by really semi, at least not, if not fully, democratic regimes. That didn't happen. Definitely some dictators were toppled. Ben Ali, Mubarak of Egypt, Ali Abdullah in Yemen, but that's about it. And the Arab Spring became stalled as the authoritarian forces regained power, and the Arab Spring became the Arab Winter. And then it really became something else with Syria, which devolved into a full-scale civil war involving different religious factions against the government of Bashar al-Assad, which is incredibly brutal. And we have now the rise of very violent, radical Islamic movements that got a foothold in Syria during the fighting. And now one of them has spread to northern Iraq. And this is the latest news you've been reading about. This movement calls itself the Islamic State. It used to be called the Islamic State of Syria and Iraq. And they are declaring a caliphate, which is a Muslim type of government.
Well, tell us, it just as a little background here, because we're going to talk in a few moments about the current situation.
Okay.
But remind our listeners what a caliphate is, because that's a technical term, I believe.
Well, caliphate was a term used to describe the early Islamic governments after the death of Prophet Muhammad in the 7th century. And basically, the last caliphate was the Ottoman Empire. And the Ottoman Empire, you know, ruled the Arab world in the Middle East for centuries. And it was generally, not always, but generally a peaceful rule because the Muslims, the Arab Muslims, liked being led by a Muslim leader. And there was a lot of regional autonomy and local autonomy. So individual different sects had their own rules to govern their community. It was a way, sort of a mini federalized system to keep the peace. And the Ottomans had sort of inherited historically the banner of the caliphate. At the end of World War I, as you know, the caliphate was abolished when current-day or present-day Turkey was formed. And Kemal Atatürk, who led the First Republic of Turkey, abolished the caliphate. I guess he felt it was no longer relevant, and in a way it wasn't, because the boundaries of the region were being withdrawn by the victorious Allied powers, mainly Britain and France. And that's where we get the present-day boundaries of Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, and Jordan.
And that's why we hear on the news fairly often that these were false boundaries that...
Right, because a lot of people felt that the French and the British, you know, drew these arbitrary boundaries, and they did. Some of them went through the middle of a tribal area, so you had half the tribe living in one country and half the tribe in another country. And then not only did they withdraw boundaries, but they set up governments in these places, which did not always reflect local realities, and you know, they were certainly not democratic governments, and they lasted the rest of the century.
So as part of what we're seeing today, and I'll ask Don to join in here, is part of what we're seeing today kind of the collapse of these boundaries?
Well, that's a very insightful comment, and many people are arguing that now, because the caliphate declared a couple of weeks ago by this violent jihadi group called Islamic State certainly it doesn't recognize the boundary between Syria and Iraq any longer, and I don't think we're in a situation where the current national boundaries are in any danger of collapsing. I think that the Islamic State is not going to get very much further in getting rid of boundaries.
And why do you say that?
Because it's such a violent, dangerous movement. I feel that the Muslim authorities in the Middle East and the Western powers will take a stand against it eventually. And it's very interesting because Iran, which is Shia, is very much against this radical group because it is Sunni, and it threatens Iran's interests in the Middle East, which are to keep Bashar al-Assad, the Syrian leader, in power. They are allied. And Iraq always also has great influence in Iraq, which is another majority Shia state. So Iran does not want to see this Islamic State erase the boundaries of two countries where it has considerable influence. And of course, this group has attracted a lot of foreign fighters from the West, principally Europe. So all these European governments are worried that these jihadi fighters will come back and cause mayhem in their own countries. So I see a global consensus against this movement.
It seems to me that one of the things we're seeing is perhaps the great divide of Sunni and Shia in the Islamic world. I mean, you saw sort of the rise, really almost the first Shia state when it came to Iran back in 1979. And certainly there was a concern on the part of the Saudis, who are Sunni, about their rise. That's why they funded the war between Iraq and Iran. How far does this split go? I mean, are these the two internal dynamics that are going on, this struggle between these two sects? I mean, how significant is that dynamic, and how does it play out? Because we've seen it in Iraq. We're seeing this certainly played out very violently, and even in Syria.
Unfortunately, this sectarian rivalry, competition, bitterness is on the rise, and it's a very significant factor in motivating young people to join either their government or a violent insurgency. Iran and Saudi Arabia are at odds, and they are very much concerned that not letting the other one gain influence in the same area. There's a lot of sectarian rhetoric that's frankly very hateful coming out particularly of Saudi Arabia against Shiites. And Saudi Arabia has its own Shiite population. About 10% of Saudi Arabia population is Shiite. But the government's sort of allowing this rhetoric because it gets people worked up to support its efforts to get rid of Bashar al-Assad in Syria. Of course, the problem now for Saudi Arabia is much bigger with the rise of this Islamic State movement in northern Iraq and Syria.
Because I was going to ask, because it seems to me that the Saudis have this interest in stability amongst everything else, and the Islamic State and those folks, they certainly don't represent stability that they have betted on for years.
Absolutely not. I mean, this group is challenging the fundamental political foundations of the current Middle East, and of course they are virulently anti House of Saud, the royal family of Saudi Arabia. I personally think that the way to bring down the tension, stop the conflict, is for Saudi Arabia and Iran to sit down and come to some type of condominium of influence in their region. But I don't think Saudi Arabia, I don't know about Iran, but I don't think Saudi Arabia is quite yet ready to do that. I think they want to keep on supporting their side and getting and reducing the influence of Iran in the Arab world, because you know Iran is not Arab; it's a different ethnic group. It's Persian. So there's both the religious rivalry, Sunni versus Shia, and the ethnic rivalry, Arab versus Persian, when it comes to this competition between Iran and Saudi Arabia.
One of the things we're experiencing is this increase in terrorism and the use of terrorism as a political strategy. Give us a little background, if you would, on the role of Islam in today's Middle East, and how does something that is such a significant religion become associated with such a horrible political tactic such as terrorism?
Well, it's very complicated, but let me try to make it in a simple kind of flow. Islam has very many different interpretations, and you can get, you know, four or five different interpretations of Islamic scripture in the same community. And this is why Islam is prided itself on being, at least theologically, a sort of democratic, because it, unlike Christianity, which has very strongly a clerical class, the Islamic faith does not believe in clerics. Now, does that mean they don't have any religious authorities? No. But these authorities generally in the past have come up through the community, through their learning, through their sagacity, through their willingness to take on contemporary issues and make opinions and get a following. So it's been very organic. Now, what happened in the beginning of the 20th century, these new governments created by France and Britain came into power, and actually this happened under the Ottoman Empire too. The Ottomans appointed clerics who would be their guys and approve anything they did according to the Islamic scripture. So, of course, these state-appointed clerics became in favor of the state. And, you know, then fast forward 60, 70 years, and you get states where the clerics are state-employed, the government's controlling what can be said in the mosques, and you get the people who now feel alienated from the traditional religious leaders because they see them as too pro-government and not caring enough about the people. Now, this did not cause everybody to join in a violent group, but all of a sudden you're getting young people who are interpreting Islamic scriptures themselves and coming to very radical interpretations. And those radical interpretations eventually led to violent interpretations. And then politically, you had all these people, these young people being disaffected, and some of them, not all of them, but some of them being attracted to these violent, radical interpretations. Okay, then you had Afghanistan. Afghanistan was invaded by the Soviet Union. And the United States, in collaboration with Saudi Arabia and other governments, decided to back Afghan guerrillas or freedom fighters against the Soviets. Well, they did that, and they lost control of the ideology that was being perpetrated by these Afghan guerrillas. And then you had Arab leaders like Osama bin Laden go to help out the Afghans because they were fellow Muslims. And Osama bin Laden went to Afghanistan. He had his own force of young Arabs there. And he just became more and more radical, and he developed this idea, which he says is based on an interpretation of Islam. Well, I'm sorry, but many other Islamic scholars disagree with your interpretation of this part of Islamic scriptures, which lead you to justify your violent actions. So that's a kind of theoretical explanation for what you asked me.
Well, let me ask you about a term in Islam that we hear all the time, and that is jihad. And what we hear when we hear the word jihad is that, you know, if you don't believe the way I do, I'm going to cut your head off, and I want everybody to be Islamic. And I get the sense, particularly from reading your book, that this word means much more than we kind of interpret it to mean. Right. Could you say something about that?
Yeah, the description of jihad that you've just mentioned is a recent one. Because, you know, as I said, people like Osama bin Laden, who had these radical interpretations, appropriated the term jihad because it has a holy meaning to Muslims, but I'll get into that in a minute. And so they used it to justify what they were doing violently. Jihad is a word, an Arabic word, and it comes from a root word meaning to struggle, to strive. And in Islamic theology, jihad has many different meanings. But the traditional religious leaders say the best meaning of jihad is the internal struggle to be a good Muslim, a good person. It is a spiritual struggle. Now, this has been, it was also used to mean a defensive war waged by Islamic leaders defending Islam or their territory against, say, the Crusaders in the medieval times, the Christian Crusaders from Egypt. But that kind of jihad, it can only be declared by a leader of the Islamic community, i.e. a recognized ruler. And then along came these young people, again, some of them from Egypt, saying, you know, jihad to fight against tyrannical rulers and to fight against Christians and to fight against Shia, this is an Islamic duty of every single Muslim, and you don't have to wait for the ruler to declare it. So you can see it became a very anarchistic type of jihad. And that's the meaning that Osama bin Laden took up to justify his jihads against various regimes.
Well, another word that kind of fits with jihad that we hear all the time is Sharia law. And for us, we think of Sharia law as you steal something, Sharia says we're going to cut your hand off, or these penalties, kind of penalties that are abhorrent to us that go with criminal activity. That's what we think of. But again, from reading your book, Passion for Islam, I got this sense that there is a vast actual meaning to Sharia that goes well beyond these penal activities.
Okay, Sharia basically means Islamic law. And over the centuries since Islam began, various religious scholars living in various countries sort of developed different schools of thought on how to interpret the Quran and the Sunnah. The Sunnah is the collection of authorized sayings of the Prophet Muhammad and his companions. So we have two basic Islamic scriptural texts, the Sunnah and the Quran. So over the centuries, in different parts of the world, you got four basic schools of thought. And these schools would interpret the scripture in a certain way. Now, these bodies of thoughts or schools of thoughts developed, you know, a whole schema of laws. And this was called Islamic jurisprudence. And, you know, these laws were used to keep order in communities and regulate the social behavior of communities. So Sharia doesn't mean one specific law. It means this whole body of thought. And criminal penalties, like cutting off a hand or killing someone because he renounces Islam, these are very, very severe punishments that were developed by certain religious scholars. But then you had other scholars disagreeing with how these should be applied. So, for example, the penalty for adultery is it's a capital offense. But Islamic scholars said, how are we going to judge this? Well, we're going to say that to find someone guilty of adultery, you need four independent witnesses. Now, how are you going to have four witnesses to an act of adultery? Unless perhaps a couple is doing it in public, and then you might say they're mentally ill, so they wouldn't deserve to be killed either. But modern-day Islamic governments, for some reason, this would take up another whole program, but they find it that it's necessary to control women in a very severe way. And one of the outcomes of that is in places like Iran, for example, women have been stoned to death for committing adultery. I don't know the details of these cases, but I would love to hear how they found four independent witnesses to her crime. I doubt that they had them. But again, so the bottom line is that when you hear the word Sharia, you should be thinking of a term of centuries of Islamic jurisprudence filling books and books and books, and these jurisprudence goes into how you should conduct business, how you should treat your wife, how you should dole out your inheritance, and how you should govern the life of the community.
I was wondering about that in terms of the radicalization that we've seen of Islam, in the sense that we saw Al-Qaeda, and now we've got the ISIS that's rising, and these radical interpretations. And one of the things that faces ISIS right now is now not only do obviously they've expanded, but now they have to govern. And I'm wondering how fast this thing burns out in terms of, well, this isn't exactly what I bargained for, whether it's the Sunnis in Iraq or it's others as well, where this ideology doesn't really get you anywhere in terms of seeing your children do better, getting married, being successful, that kind of thing.
A great question, Don. It gets us into a long discussion. We're going to take a short break now, and when we return, we'll talk to Carol Murphy further about the role of Sharia or jurisprudence in more radical Islam. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
In our world, ideas can be liturgy. I'm Krista Tippett. Join me on Being, generous conversation about the questions that matter most. What does it mean to be human? And how do we want to live? We explore with theologians, scientists, philosophers, thinkers, and activists every week from American Public Media.
Sunday mornings at 7 on NPR News Talk 90.7.
Ready to go. Welcome back to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. We're talking to Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Carol Murphy about the current political situation in the Middle East and the radicalization of Islam. Joining us also is Don Rush, the news director for Delmarva Public Radio. Carol, I think we left you at the break with a question.
Yes, Don asked about, how is this radically motivated ISIS going to successfully govern? And the fact is they won't. I mean, this is why they fall back on these very severe interpretations of Islam. They want women to stay at home if they go out, like the Taliban did in Afghanistan. They want them to be covered from head to toe. They don't want them to participate in public life. And they've killed people simply because they were Shia. This is going to get you nowhere in the long run. And this is one of the reasons the Taliban was not successful in Afghanistan. And even before the U.S. intervened, there was a lot of opposition to the Taliban. Another reason we said earlier in the program why I think that ISIS will not expand or will not really succeed in the long run is because there would be this united stand against them. But already they're having fights with their tribal allies, the Sunni tribesmen, who don't agree with their brand of Islam, but they joined them simply because they don't like the government in Baghdad right now. So this alliance is not going to work out very well in the long run either, because these tribal sheikhs, they have their own authority and they have their own way of doing Islam, and they don't want ISIS coming in and telling them how to do it.
Do you think from a broad perspective that this movement, this militant Islamic movement that we're seeing, will ultimately burn itself out? I mean, we've seen the Arab world, for instance, go through pan-Arabism. That lasted for a while. That transformed itself into Islamic fundamentalism, I guess, for lack of a better word. Do you think that this radical movement will ultimately burn itself out across the region there, or is it going to be there for a long time?
I think the answer is somewhere in between. I think it's definitely going to burn itself out at some point, but do I think that's going to happen in the next 4 or 5 years? Unfortunately, no. And one of the motivations, you know, giving us these radical movements is all the grievances of ordinary people, lack of jobs, a lack of good education, lack of affordable housing, lack of political participation, and having to be roughed up by the security police. In addition to that, you know, you don't have participatory governments. And on top of that, you know, have what I call this very deep crisis in Islam, theologically, because it's my belief, a lot of people disagree with me, but it's my belief that we're not going to see truly democratic regimes in the Arab world until the people who interpret Islam in a very contemporary way, who come up with interpretations of Islamic scriptures which meet the needs of the ordinary modern people living there today, then you're going to have a blossoming, I think, of more participatory democratic governments. Other people think that I have the chicken before the egg, or the egg before the chicken, but that's what I think. So I do see that the historical period we're going through in the Arab Muslim world right now is going to be lasting for at least a couple of decades.
In terms of the Quran and the interpretation of the Quran and the interpretation of the interpretation of the Quran. In the Christian world, we went through a long period of what we call, anyway, biblical criticism, in which we looked at the Bible, and we began to look at the context out of which it came. We looked at, scholars looked at who the various authors of the different books or sections of books might be. Different kinds of interpretation based on the historical period. Is that what you're saying needs to happen with the Quran or with the interpretations of the Quran?
It's my personal opinion, and again, other people disagree with me, that there will have to be a reassessment by modern Islamic scholars of how they read the Quran in order to come up with these more relevant contemporary interpretations. I mean, certainly people are already doing it. I'm not saying it's not happening, but it's very low-key and it's very isolated just among individuals. But basically, the big difference between how Muslims view the Quran and how mainstream Christians view the Bible is that mainstream Christians, you know, approach the Bible the way you've just described, as a book written by many different people with different in different contexts and should be read metaphorically, but with great, you know, meaning for people's spiritual life. On the contrary, Muslims regard every single word in the Quran as God's word. It's just direct from God through Prophet Muhammad. And this is why when American troops in Afghanistan or Iraq did anything with the Quran, like dropped it on the floor or spilled coffee on it, that the Muslims would get so upset, because they view that book as holy, because they view this as containing the direct words of God. So I really do personally think, it's my opinion, that there'll have to be a new way of looking at the Quran. This doesn't mean that the Quran is not a holy book. It just means, how do you read it? How do you interpret it to make it relevant for people today?
Is that part of the struggle that's happening in the radicalization of Islam? You've got fundamentalists who see this book in one way, as you've said earlier,
precisely.
And then you've got a more modern segment of the population who sees it in a more modern and
well, I would say that the majority of Muslims are not they view the Quran the way I've described, as the word of God. You don't have yet, maybe you never will, Muslims in the majority who view it the way mainstream Christians view the Bible. I don't see that yet. Right. And this is one of the problems in the Middle East, that the voices of the very orthodox, the very conservative Islamic leaders are a louder voice than the voice of the more moderate leaders or moderate interpreters.
One of the things that strikes me, though, is that, and depending on what country it is, women in those countries will be far more modern, I guess, have far more rights as opposed to, say, other countries. I mean, obviously, we take some extremes like the Taliban, who you described. On the other hand, in Iraq under Saddam Hussein, it was a much different place for Muslim women. How do you sort that out in terms of how you got these different treatments of women, and are we seeing a rollback with this rise of fundamentalism, for lack of a better word, to women's rights in the Arab Muslim world?
Most definitely.
I mean,
yeah, because you know, one thing that happened with the Arab Awakening, once it began to falter, you had, well, not, yeah, once the more secular oriented youth parties, which sort of launched it, began to falter, then you had the more fundamental type Muslims come to the fore, and in fact they're very popular. They won the elections in Egypt. You had the Muslim Brotherhood, and then you had the so-called Salafi parties, which the Salafis are Muslims who more or less, you know, read the Quran very literally. And between them, they got 75% of the seats in the Egyptian parliament in national fair elections. So you can see the pull of Islam is very, very strong. And the pull of Islam, which we would consider very conservative Islam, is very strong. So between their rise and between the violence now that's spreading out from Syria, women's rights are really suffering a lot. And this is one of the big concerns of a lot of people watching this, the Middle East, because you're having women being told to cover up again. You can't go to certain schools. You have to stay at home. So, and for example, in Baghdad, which is not controlled by the radical Islamic State, but it's controlled by a government that's much more religiously conservative than the government of Saddam Hussein. So women have seen rollbacks in their rights there. So it's not a good scene for women. And, you know, the fact that this historical process may take decades to roll itself out,
well, you
is
mentioned,
not good for women.
You mentioned earlier, Carol, this need to control women. Where does this... Two things, I guess. First, where does this need, in your sense, come from? How does this emerge out of the religion? And then the second part of the question is, as a woman working in the Muslim world, did you feel pressures relative to carrying out your job as a woman?
I think it's fair to say that in the Arab world, this repression of women does not come from Islam as much as it comes from the Arab culture. And the Arab culture then has appropriated interpretations of Islam to justify how women were treated. So you have a combination of retrogressive interpretations of Islamic scripture to justify putting women down, combined with a very male-dominated and male-domineering Arab culture. And that's why those two things coming together is bad times for women. Now, Muslims will tell you, and this is true, that when Islam came, it elevated the status of women from what was previously prevailing. For example, the tribes before Prophet Muhammad gave his testimony and founded Islam, the tribes used to kill infant daughters because they were a burden. They wanted sons. He forbade that. And he made it so that women would get a share of inheritance and that they could do things on their own. His first wife was older than him, and she was a successful businesswoman. Her name was Khadija. So she was an example for Islamic women for centuries of an independent, you know, woman who made her own career.
And so what happened here, Carol?
What happened was, I think, that cultures appropriated Islam, and very conservative Islamic trends became dominant, and together they just changed the way women were treated.
And you?
Well, people often ask me this question, and I'm afraid I have to give a very boring answer. it really didn't affect my job at all. For some reason, you know, a lot of the people you have to see as a journalist were officials. They spoke English. They kind of gave you a pass because you were a Western woman. You were not expected to behave exactly as one of their women. But also a lot of them had experience and exposure to Western societies, so they knew that we didn't follow their rules. But that wasn't to say that I lived in Saudi Arabia for 3 years, and every woman there has to wear the abaya, which is the black robe that covers your dress. And Saudi women all cover their hair. Not all of them. Some cover their face from the eyes down. I myself, as a Westerner, I did not cover my hair, and I never wore a face veil. I did cover my hair out of respect if I was going to interview a religious figure or someone senior in the government, or I was going to a government office. But if I went shopping in the mall, I wouldn't wear it. So, I mean, there were a couple of times in Saudi Arabia where they had press conferences just for men, but the women were in another room and it was piped in. I mean, I didn't like that, but I got what I needed. So,
I guess that
I couldn't drive, of course, in Saudi Arabia, so I had to hire a driver.
Right, but you generally...
Which was fine with me.
Yeah, but you generally have a driver in a place like those, like Egypt and Saudi Arabia, don't you?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
But the point is, you couldn't drive even if you wanted to in Saudi Arabia.
Right. So you were accorded interviews that didn't interfere. You got audiences with you wanted to speak
My male colleagues had as much trouble as I did getting interviews with Saudi officials. It's not easy.
I want to turn to the current conflict in Israel and the Gaza Strip. We've now got shelling going on, certainly from both sides, from the Israelis into Gaza. They say they're targeting Hamas areas. Hamas has apparently been firing rockets into Israel, and there doesn't seem to be any let-up at the moment. In fact, Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister from Israel, says he expects this to go on much longer, that there's a much longer haul than just a few rocket jets. What do you make of what's going on there?
Well, I think that Israel is really overreacting to the initial event. The initial event was a horrible, brutal murder of 3 innocent teenagers. They immediately blamed Hamas. I didn't see them present any evidence. I haven't heard that they've arrested the people who perpetrated this event. So if they were so sure of the perpetrators, why are they overreacting like this. Now, I know that Hamas is sending rockets in, and Israel has to respond to that, too. But, you know, my position always is that Israel should be the more mature partner here, and Israel should do, you know, the more mature thing rather than responding on the level of the Hamas by firing indiscriminate rockets into Israeli territory. So, you know, this has been going on now for 60, 70 years, this conflict, and it's really poisoned the whole region. And I'm not saying that this is the cause of Arab Muslim problems today, because we've just spent almost an hour talking about those problems. But it is a very much an aggravating factor that has kept the region from developing normally. For example, because of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, authoritarian governments would claim, well, we have to have all this security because, you know, we're fighting Israel, when really they wanted all that security so they could stay in power. So it's been a useful tool, propaganda tool, for Arab leaders. But nevertheless, Kerry has done his best to get some kind of agreement. It's very, 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 very dangerous, because support for the two-state solution, which would have been an easy thing 40 years ago, is now almost gone. So you're left with wondering, well, if we don't have two states, what are we going to have? And right now it looks like continual fighting.
One of the things that struck me is that, in particular, if you read about some of the Zionist leaders who basically formed the Israeli state and fought for it. Within that is Zionist movement, there was a recognition that there might be problems ahead. There were concerns about the impact on Arabs that were living there before the establishment of the Israeli state. And we have a very vigorous debate within the Zionist movement. And it sounds like here we are some 50, 60 years or so after the establishment of the Israeli state, and we're still looking at the same kinds of arguments and the same kinds of problems that they themselves had looked at.
Well, I would argue that recent Israeli governments have been captured by the settler population, and they don't care about the Palestinians. They want the Palestinians to be evacuated from the West Bank so that they can have their, what they see as their religious entity in all the land of Israel, including the West Bank. Nobody wants Gaza. It's just a problem. Unfortunately, I don't see the concerns of these early Zionist leaders, which I agree they did have, being a factor anymore.
That sounds more like the Meir Kahane solution of just expelling all the Palestinians.
That's what the settler movement believes in.
Well, that's what it's about, isn't it, terms of crowding?
And the way they're doing it is to settling. There are now over 500,000 Jews living in the West Bank, and this is a violation of a Geneva Convention, and nothing has been done about it. Nothing. For 60 years. So they have created now a new problem. Whereas before they started settling the West Bank, there was the territory, there was the land, there was the availability of territory for a Palestinian state. Today it's a joke, because there's no territory left that doesn't look like Swiss cheese, with a lot of areas populated by settlements. So, you know, the ideal solution would be one democratic state, but then you can't have a Jewish state or a Muslim state. You've got to have a secular democratic state. And the populations of both Israel and Palestine are not ready for that right now. Religion is too much a factor in people's minds.
Carol, we've discussed a lot of problems about the Middle East and the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Let me put you on the spot and ask you, what directions do we? I won't ask you what the solutions are because
that would be
a little much. But let me ask you, in your opinion, what directions should we be going to solve the problems that we've just outlined for the last almost an hour?
You know, I don't know where to begin, and most recently, I've been coming to the position that there is nothing that outsiders can do except contain the violence and keep track through their counterterrorism operations of what the bad guys are planning to do outside the Middle East. I've come to the conclusion that apart from that containment policy, maybe we just have to sit back and see all these trends run their course, which is horrible for the people living there. But, you know, you've seen what Senator Kerry has come up against with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I've never seen a Secretary of State work so hard to get an agreement, and he's come up with nothing. The United States has been telling Prime Minister Maliki of Iraq he has to reach out to the Sunnis. He's ignored us. In Syria, I think President Obama rightly didn't want to get involved in that. We didn't want to get involved in another quagmire. As soon as the United States got directly involved, it would be a magnet for these young jihadis from all over the world, because then they would get a chance to fight Americans again. I think he did the right thing to stay out, but we have no way to influence events there. The president of Egypt, he says to Washington, "I'm sorry, I'm going to do my own thing," you know, and so it might have to be that we take a much lower profile, sit back, try to do our best to help people who want to come here for an education, give scholarships. You know, offer to help stable states with their health needs, building hospitals, training nurses, but to stay out of the political situation and just let events run their course. I think, as I said before, it's a very depressing situation right now in the Middle East. I don't see many lights on the horizon.
Well, Carol Murphy, thank you very much for being with us today, and thank you for your reporting on the Middle East and your insights. They are crucial for our understanding this, I think, very uncertain world that we live in today. And Don, thank you for participating in our discussion as well. Okay, everyone, with knowledge comes the beginning, at least, of understanding and wisdom in terms of our relationship to the Middle East. And to increase your knowledge, I highly recommend Carol's two books, Passion for Islam and The Kingdom's Future. I've read both of them. They're excellent books. And thank you all for listening to Delmarva Today, the Writer's Edition.
You've been listening to a special Writer's Edition of Delmarva Today with your host, Harold Wilson. This program is produced on the campus of Salisbury University for Delmarva Public Radio. Christopher Rank is your audio engineer. Mary Seaman is the volunteer producer. Visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, for podcasts of this program.